Let's go ahead and get started on another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening to the book of Joel, chapter number 3, where we broke off at the end of our last session. Now, Joel, I think, was probably written shortly before the Babylonian invasion of Judea in 605 BC. Can't be positive about that because there's no clear-cut dating information inside the book, but it does kind of go along with some of the prophecies from the same time period about the coming judgment on the country of Judea. Now, Joel has been talking about an invasion of locusts. And I said that that could be a literal locust plague, or it could be a metaphor for the coming of the Babylonians, or it might even be kind of a double entendre, a double meaning, where both are in mind. But the day of the Lord is mentioned in this book on a couple of occasions. And the day of the Lord sometimes has a near fulfillment of judgment coming either in the time of the prophet that's writing this down or sometime shortly thereafter. The Babylonians coming is definitely going to be a day of the Lord. However, we know that the day of the Lord is also used about that period of time right before Jesus returns. Book of Revelation is a presentation of the day of the Lord, 3.5 year period, right before Jesus comes. So it could be that some of these day of the Lord references in the book of Joel, as in other books of the Old Testament, have at least a little bit of contribution to the concept of the ultimate day of the Lord. So I want you to keep that in mind, as once again, that phrase will come up in our Joel passage today. So here we go, chapter number 3. For behold, in those days and at that time, I will restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. And I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, it is the translation opinion of these English translators that this is a proper noun. The name Jehoshaphat, and perhaps even a relationship to the king Jehoshaphat. I take a different tact on that, as do other Bible students. I believe the meaning of the name is important here. The valley of He who is has judged. The J-E-H on the beginning of this word is all about Yah. It's the short form of Yahweh. So it is the name of God followed by the word for judged. So God is saying here that at some time in the future, He's going to bring all the nations, all the Gentiles, down to a specific valley of judgment. Verse number 2 continues, and I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my heritage Israel, because they have scattered them among the nations and have divided up my land and have cast lots for my people and have traded a boy for a prostitute and have sold a girl for wine and have drunk it. Now what happens is, as Judea is overwhelmed by foreign forces, some of the other nations nearby will end up getting involved in the slave trade. When nations are overrun by armies, people are captured, and these civilians are often sold as a means of gaining war reparation money from the losing side for the winning side. And so they end up going into slavery. And then those slaves are sold on by the ones that originally bought them. But also people who become refugees, try to run away from the action, end up sometimes being captured. by other groups nearby, and they make them into slaves and figure they can get away with it because, hey, the whole place is chaotic. So God here is saying, I've taken into consideration that that's been going on, and I am going to bring judgment on those ethnic groups that have done that to my people, who have sold them so that they could have sex with a prostitute, or have sold them so that they could get some wine so they could have a good time, maybe even get drunk. And so God says, I will judge. Verse 4, what are you to me, O Tyre and Sidon, and all the regions of Philistia? So that'd be the Mediterranean coastline that borders the Judean kingdom and the now desolated lands of the northern kingdom of Israel. And so they sometimes were involved in the slave trade. So God says, are you paying me back for something? If you are paying me back, I will return your payment on your head swiftly and speedily. We know that some of these places on the coast had been judged by God through the Israeli people conquering them and taking them captive. And so God says, do you think you're getting back at me through the people by capturing them and selling them off? Well, guess what? I'll turn around and I will pay you back for that attitude. And that would be appropriate because the reason that they were in trouble the first time is because God was bringing judgment on them. And so when you react against God's judgment, expect judgment again. Verse 5, for you have taken my gold and my silver and my gold, have carried my rich treasures into your temples. You have sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks in order to remove them far from their own border. Now the Greek peoples were starting to be much more active in the eastern Mediterranean basin, and so they were in the market for buying some of these slaves and taking them back to the Greek homelands. So that's why they're kind of mentioned here. Verse 7, behold, I will stir up from the place to which you have sold them, and I will return your payment on your own head. I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hand of the people of Judah, and they will sell them to the Sabaeans, to a nation far away, for he who is has spoken. In other words, if you keep this up, if you keep treating my people, the Israelis, as if they're just a product, I will bring judgment on your hand, on your heads, and that will include you losing wars and having some of your people, your civilians in particular, go into slavery for losing those wars, and they will end up going down into the deep parts of Arabia. Verse number 9. Proclaim this among the nations. Consecrate for war. Stir up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. And let the weak say, I am a warrior. So this is all talk of get ready for war. The whole Middle East has been caught up in this fight between the waning power of the Assyrians, who's kind of backed up by the Egyptians from the south, and the rising star of the Babylonians, and then beyond them, the rising star of the Medes as well. And so everybody better get ready to be involved in the fight. This was their run-up to a world war. And so to do that, they needed to take their agricultural implements, like plowshares, and harvest the metal from those plowshares and repurpose them into swords and pruning hooks into spears. It's interesting that the opposite direction of this shows up in the book of Isaiah, I think, about how when God finally becomes the ultimate king and judge of the world, then there will be peace and swords and spears will be able to be turned into agricultural implements. But here, verse 11 continues, "Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, gather yourselves there, bring down your warriors, O he who is. Let the nations stir themselves up and come up to the valley of he who judges," he who is the one that judges. "For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations." It is at this point that I want to suggest to you that Joel is not just simply seeing some things that are going to happen with the Babylonians coming to the Middle East, because they will do some of these very things, and some of the nations will suffer for their sinful activities. Nor will it be just the things that will happen when the Greeks come into the area, because again, God will use them as a judging tool. Nor will the Medes and the Persians, when they come as God's judgment tool, completely fulfill all these things, or the Romans even. The ultimate fulfillment of some of these things, especially what's coming up next, is Jesus Christ, when he returns as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords to the Middle East, to Jerusalem, and brings into existence the new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells. And the reason I say that with confidence is because the next verse is actually portrayed in the book of Revelation about Jesus' ultimate judgment. Verse 13, "Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Go in, tread, for the winepress is full, the vats overflow, for their evil is great." In the New Testament book of Revelation, we talk about the grapes of God's wrath coming to their complete ripeness. And then they are harvested and judgment comes. And so this apparently has, here in the book of Joel, some connection to that second coming of Jesus, which is portrayed as a harvest of wrath in Revelation 14. Verse 14, "Multitudes and multitudes in the valley of decision." That's another name for the valley of Jehoshaphat, or the valley where he who is has judged. It's the valley where decisions are made, decisions for eternity. "For the day of he who is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon are darkened and the stars withdraw their shining." And we know, book of Revelation, also earlier in the book of Joel, that before that final day of the Lord, the 3.5 years that leads up to Jesus returning, the sun is going to go dark. The moon is going to lose some of its luminous qualities. It will turn blood red. And the stars are going to fall from the sky. They're going to quit their shining in a normal fashion. And the stars here kind of stand for two things, meteor type action coming out of the sky, but also fallen angels will be booted out of the heavenly dimension into the earthly dimension. That's Revelation chapter 12, where Satan and his angels will be kicked out for the 3.5 year period previous to Jesus' return. Verse 16, "He who is roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem." You might remember back in Amos, God was presenting himself as the lion of judgment that is coming. He utters his voice in Jerusalem. "The heavens and the earth quake." Those are elements that certainly deal with the last day of the Lord. "And he who is a refuge for his people, a stronghold to the people of Israel." So even though the judgment is coming with earlier days of the Lord and then the ultimate day of the Lord, God still provides refuge for those that call on the name of the Lord. Verse 17, so you shall know that I am he who is your God, who dwell in Zion, my holy mountain, and Jerusalem shall be holy, and strangers shall never again, notice that, never again pass through it. That's one of the things that makes me believe that we've got final day of the Lord elements in this passage, because it is referencing a point past which wicked people will still be able to come to Jerusalem. Verse 18, and in that day, the mountains shall drip sweet wine, so very productive. The hills shall flow with milk. The idea, again, very productive. The agriculture is not just the fruit that comes off the trees, but it's also the fruit that comes from the animals. And all the stream beds of Judah shall flow with water. We've seen droughts associated with the curse and with judgment. And so that means flowing waters, flowing streams are associated with blessing and life-giving. And then we see something really, really important for future prophecy. Verse number 18 finishes with, and a fountain shall come forth from the house of he who is and water the valley of Shittim. Now, Shittim is the Jordan Valley immediately north of the Dead Sea. It's the valley of the acacia trees. And so there is a prophecy here that we will see in the book of Ezekiel as well, and then we will see it ultimately in the book of Zechariah. But there is a prophecy that a brand new spring of water is going to come up on the Temple Mount. And then it is going to flow through a brand new valley that shows up as Jesus is returning, that cuts through the existing Mount of Olives to the east. And this new water is going to flow through that new valley and go down into the area by the north end of the Dead Sea and bring life to it, according to the other passages that we will eventually get to. So this is clearly, in my mind, a prophecy about the second coming of Jesus and the kickoff of the millennial age in the new heavens and new earth. Verse 19, Egypt shall be a desolation and Edom a desolate wilderness. Now those are references to the judgment of God upon the wicked peoples of both those places. It says, for the violence done to the people of Judah because they have shed innocent blood in their land. So those places are going to be depopulated of their wicked people. Now, there will still be righteous people in Egypt that will survive that because they've called upon the name of the Lord. There will apparently be righteous, God-fearing people in Edom that will call upon the name of the Lord, and they will be spared. But the judgment of God will come on those places, and then verses 20 and 21 says this, Judah shall be inhabited forever and Jerusalem to all generations. This is going against the backdrop of the already happened exile of northern Israel. That northern kingdom had been depopulated. The inhabitants were either killed in the Assyrian invasion or they were moved out by this deportation policy. So it's desolate of Israelis up there in the north. And Judah is going to be the next place depopulated when the Babylonians come in. But once Jesus comes back, once everything has been resolved, And we get through to the other end of the 3.5 years that's presented in the book of Revelation. Then Judah and Jerusalem are going to be inhabited forever by righteous people. Verse 21, I will avenge their blood, blood I have not avenged, for he who is dwells in Zion. So God just wants to get it on the books, make it very clear that despite what happens under the Babylonians with the depopulation of Judea, ultimately God is going to make the promised land full of his righteous people. And nobody will be able to put a stop to that. Even the wicked people that try are going to be put down by God. All right, so that finishes the book of Joel. Now I would like for you to turn to the prophetic book of Daniel that actually starts with several chapters that are historical chapters. And chapter number 1 is going to take place, we are told, in the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. And we know that from one standard, that started in the fall of 606 BC. So the events that we are first going to glean out of the book of Daniel happen the following spring in 605 BC. Now, this is what's happening on the world stage in that time period, the Middle Eastern stage where there's chaos. We've had this fighting back and forth between Babylon, which is growing as a new empire, and Assyria, which is shrinking away as the old empire. And the Babylonians and their allies have basically been cleaning the clocks of the Assyrians and making them give up territory. And the Babylonians just keep pushing them farther and farther west. Well, the Egyptians under Necho have functioned at some point as the allies of the Assyrians. And so they see this as a bad turn of events for themselves. Because if the Assyrians are totally wiped out by the Babylonians and their allies, then it's possible that the next target of that group would be Egypt, the other breadbasket of the Middle East. Mesopotamia, where Babylon is located, being the big breadbasket. So, in 606 BC, the Egyptians had actually gotten a good victory against the king of Babylon, a man by the name of Nabopolassar. And he was an older gentleman, and he retreats back home, and even his son kind of gets chased out of the area by the Egyptians. And so the next spring, 605, the crown prince, a man by the name of Nebuchadnezzar, is sent out by his ailing father to deal with those rascally Egyptians. And so Nebuchadnezzar goes to Carchemish, and he soundly defeats the Egyptians and sends them packing southward. And he chases them all the way down past Hamat and chases them past what we look at as being Judah and the Promised Land, and chases them basically all the way down to the dividing line between Judah and Egypt, a place called the Brook of Egypt. That's down near the Gaza Strip area. Once he is done doing that, Nebuchadnezzar, once he's done doing that, he comes back to Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem has shown themselves at one point to be interested in supporting Babylon, but most recently they have been forced into supporting Egypt. Their current king was appointed by Necho. So this is what happens next. Daniel 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Now that's jumping ahead of the story by just a few weeks. He will soon be the king. He came to Jerusalem and he besieged it. So basically he just puts his troops around it and gives them not much choice. You need to surrender. And they do. Verse 2. And the Lord, he who is, gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. So Jerusalem surrenders. They don't have much choice. They can't hold out against the Babylonians. So they open up Jerusalem and they give to him the custody of some of the tableware of God, things from the temple. And what does he do with that? He holds them hostage. It says he brought them to the land of Shinar, that's just another name for Babylon, to the house of his God, and he placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. And that was very common practice to show, my God is better than your God. Your God has to surrender to my God and give my God stuff. And so that's what Crown Prince Nebuchadnezzar did when he came to Jerusalem. He took things from God's temple and he will store them in his own God's temple. And those will come into a later story. But he did one other thing while he was there that we'll talk about the next time we get into God's Word.